In the studio this morning, I have Tuma Hazu. Tuma was born and educated in Jerusalem and joined the BBC Arabic service in London as an announcer, reporter and producer, and is now living in New Zealand. Kia ora, Tuma. Thank you for coming in and wanting to tell your story to the New Zealand public.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm really honored to be here and to have this chat with you about the problem between the Israelis and the Palestinians.
Tuma, for all my life on earth, sadly, there has always been a huge problem in the Middle East. It's so tough that quite often I cannot read the newspapers about it, and often I don't even want to watch television because it hurts me so much. Can you give our listeners an overview and understanding of what happened for this conflict to start back 60 plus years ago?
Well, actually, it started over 100 years ago. It started with the persecution first of Tsarist White Russia, of Jews in Russia, and also in Central and Western Europe at the end of the 19th century. And this went on into the 20th century. At the time, a man, a journalist, Austrian Jewish journalist, with the name of Theodor Herzl, decided that it's about time that this persecution should come an end, and the only way to do it is to gather the Jews around the world and put them back in the Holy Land. This was actually materialized when the British gave the Zionist movement in 1917 through the then Foreign Minister of Great Britain, Lord Balfour, the Balfour Declaration. That declaration committed Great Britain and its government to establish a homeland for the Jews in Palestine. Now, the interesting thing about this is this was in 1917, before the Turks were pushed out of Palestine. The Turks then at that time and for the past 400 years were ruling the Middle East, all the countries in the Middle East, including Palestine and Jerusalem at its heart. The British did that at a time when they had encouraged the Arabs. If you remember the story of Lawrence of Arabia, and if you read the book or saw the film, the British had encouraged the Arabs to rise against the Turks and join forces with the British to kick the Turks, who were the allies of Germany, with whom Britain and France were at war with in the First World War, to kick out the Turks from the Middle East with the help of the British, and in return, Britain would give them, allow them to be sovereigns and rulers of their own liberated territories, liberated from Turkish occupation. But Britain reneged on that promise, yet lived up to its promise to the Jews, to the Zionist movement, by establishing a homeland for the Jews. Because at the end of the First World War, in 1918, Britain and France, its allies, split up the loots of the war. And in the Middle East, France was given responsibility to administer Syria and Lebanon, and Britain gave itself the right to govern and administer Iraq, Transjordan, that's the territory east of the River Jordan, and Palestine. And it moved in under the leadership of Allenby and established an administration in Palestine, and with that, Britain opened the gates of immigration into Palestine of Jews from all over the world, especially from Europe and Russia. And then this frightened the local indigenous Arab population in Palestine. And Arab were both Muslim and Christian Arabs, because they were the majority at the time. At the time the Balfour Declaration was made, the Jews constituted only 6% of the population, and they owned only 2% of the land. The rest was owned by the Palestinian Arabs, both Christian and Muslim, and they were the majority. Then the Second World War happened, and we all know what happened to the Jews in Europe under German, Nazi Germany. They were persecuted, they were murdered, they were slaughtered, and we all know about the Holocaust, a very sad page in the history of mankind. But nevertheless, at the end of the war, the Jews were encouraged to come and settle further into Palestine. At the end of the Second World War, the Jews, with the help of the British mandate over Palestine, the percentage of Jews in Palestine had jumped from 6% in 1917 to 30% of the population in Palestine. But still the majority, the 70%, were Muslim and Christian Arabs. At the time, there were a lot of bloodshed, as you probably know, between the Jews and the British forces, the Jews and the Arabs and the British, the Arabs and the Jews in Palestine. So it became a very messy situation, and Britain washed its hands of the whole problem and handed it to the United Nations. The United Nations came up with a plan which was based on a partition plan put forward originally by the British, which gave the Jews, the minority population of Palestine, 56% of the land of Palestine, and gave the majority, 70% Arabs of Palestine, 42% of Palestine, leaving about 2-3% as an international area zone around Jerusalem to be administered by the United Nations. The Arabs, who were in the majority, of course, turned that down. They said, this is not fair. We are the majority. We own most of this land. We've been living here for centuries, since time of Christ and even before, because the Palestinians, who are the Palestinians? They are descendants of the Canaanites and the Philistines. And these are the two peoples, according to the Torah and the Bible, are the indigenous people of Palestine. Because there were no Jews in the Holy Land before Abraham. Abraham, who came from southern Iraq, was the first Hebrew. And he settled in the Holy Land, in Palestine. And because he obeyed the commandments of the Lord, he was ready to sacrifice his son Isaac to prove that he is righteous and obeys the commands of the Lord. God sent his archangel and stopped him from slaying his son and said, the Lord is pleased with you, and he's so pleased that he is rewarding you and he's giving you and promising you, you and the people who come after you, the land of Canaan. So God gave them somebody else's land. The Canaanites were there before the Jews. And the Philistines, the Canaanites, by the way, were in what is now known as the West Bank, the hinterland, the hilly side, the highlands of Palestine. On the coast, there were the Philistines, as we all know from the Bible. And they lived from along the coast from Sidon, in modern Lebanon, all the way to Gaza. So there were no Jews in Palestine before these two people. The indigenous people of Palestine were the Canaanites and the Philistines. And the Palestinians of today are the descendants of those two indigenous people, and possibly also some of the Jews who, depending on which army is invading and occupying the land, and whether they were forced to give up their religion, let's say Jews to become Christians or Muslims and the other way around, the Palestinians of today are the descendants of those people. The Israelites in history only controlled the Holy Land for a total of 70 years in two periods, the Kingdom of Israel and the Kingdom of Judea. So the Palestinians have been there much longer than the Jews. Now, of course, the Jews and pro-Israelis, never mention these facts. These are facts mentioned in the Bible, in the Torah, in the documentation of the British administration of Palestine. So here we have two people fighting over the same land. Jews and Palestinians, Christians and Arabs fighting for the same land. And this is the problem.
So when the United Nations put this plan in place, Israel became a state in 1948.
Yes. Now, the first thing to remember, and this is also a fact, this was a United Nations General Assembly recommendation. It wasn't binding. In the United Nations, the only binding resolutions are the Security Council resolutions. Anyway, this recommendation, the Jews accepted it and established their state of Israel, the new state of Israel, based on that recommendation. The Arabs turned it down because, as I said earlier, they said, we are the majority, you are giving the lion's share of the land to the minority, and we refuse that. And as a result, war broke out between the new state of Israel and those Arab armies who had come to stop the exodus and the expulsion of Palestinians out of Palestine. Because this expulsion didn't just suddenly happen in May 1948. It had been going on through 1947 and the first few months of 1948. By that time, over 200,000 Palestinians had been kicked out of their homes and villages. And Israel, when it established itself, wasn't satisfied to keep the 54% of the land that the United Nations allotted the Jews, but went on to occupy another 50% of Palestine. So by the time in 1949, when hostilities between the two sides came to an end, the new state of Israel was occupying 78% of historical Palestine, leaving the majority with 22%. Even that 22% was taken over and occupied by Israel in the June War of 1967. So now Israel controls all over all historical Palestine, what became known as the State of Israel and the West Bank and Gaza.
And of course, the West Bank was sort of affiliated to the Jordanians, had a say in assisting the Palestinians at that time.
Yes, that's true, because the Jordanian army moved in to protect what was left of Arab territory in Palestine. And 2 years later, that territory with its people decided to join Transjordan, East Jordan, and become the United Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. So that territory west of the River Jordan became known as the West Bank of the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, and that title has stayed until this day, the West Bank. Gaza came under the administration and protection of the Egyptian army, and the Egyptians were kicked out of Gaza in 1967.
And there's the Golan Heights as well.
And the Golan Heights were taken over at the same time from the Syrians, because the Golan Heights are Syrian territory, occupied territory.
And since then, of course, things have only escalated.
And they will continue to escalate, because basically the Zionist movement wants the land without the people. You know, the Israelis and the Zionists have always, and people who defend Israel, have always used Palestine. There was never a country called Palestine in history. They said Palestinians. Golda Meir, the ex-late prime minister of Israel, said, Palestinians? There are no people, such people as Palestinians. They don't exist. And since their occupation of the West Bank and Gaza in 67, the Israelis say, occupation? Of course there is no occupation. This is our territory. This is our promised land. And they refer to it as disputed. Disputed between Israel and Jordan. But that's only a way of misleading the public. Was the West Bank and Gaza ever part of Israel? So Israel there as an occupier. So it can't be disputed territory. It is unoccupied territory. And they keep on denying this, even if we come to the latest horrendous attack on the flotilla, right, humanitarian aid on the high sea in territorial waters. The Israelis are calling these peace activists. They're not peace activists. They are tied to Al-Qaeda. They are tied to Hamas. They are tied to Iran, to the fundamentalists in Turkey. They have to give an excuse for all their crimes against the Palestinians. And what they did on the high seas is a crime against humanity. You don't attack. Why didn't they wait until these ships entered territorial waters of Israel or even Gaza? But they decided to attack it on the high seas. Now, many of these ships carried lots of food, medicines, building materials, especially cement. Now, what are the Israelis going to do with this cement? I'm asking this question because cement is on a list of prohibited items by Israel to be imported into Gaza. Did you know that?
That I didn't know.
Well, I have a list here by Gisha. Gisha is an Israeli human rights group based in Israel, and they published the following, the long list, I'll read a few, a list of prohibited items that Israel forbids from entering Gaza or being imported into Gaza. For instance, cardamom, coriander seeds, ginger, jam, vinegar, nutmeg, chocolate, potatoes, gas for soft drinks, plaster, wood for construction, cement, iron, plastic, glass, and metal containers, and the list goes on and on and on. And there are items that are needed in everyday life by the Gaza people in the Gaza Strip. The Gaza Strip is now one huge open prison surrounded by Israel. From three sides, the sea, that's the western side, the north, which is the southern border of Israel with the Gaza Strip, and the eastern side, which is the Israeli border with the Gaza Strip from the east, and then you have the southern border of Gaza Strip, controlled by America's ally in the Middle East and an undeclared ally of Israel, Egypt. Egypt has blocked that border so that Palestinians cannot go in and out of the Gaza Strip.
What is the population of the people in Gaza at the moment?
There are about 1.5 million people. Now, that is, if you take the whole of the population of Auckland and metropolitan Auckland, including the new super city of Auckland, I'm referring to about 1.5 million people, and you put them in an area like the North Shore, from Devonport to Browns Bay. That is the Gaza Strip. It is the most populated spot on earth, far more than Hong Kong. It's very little green areas. Farmlands have been destroyed, continuously being destroyed by Israel. They don't have running water because Israel bombed their pumping stations. They don't have fuel to light their homes and pump water to apartments which are above street level. 45,000 Palestinians in Gaza are living in tents as a result of the horrendous attack by Israel in late 2008 and January 2009, which left over 1,400 Palestinians killed, with about 452 children under the age of 16 as victims killed as a result of Israeli horrendous military attacks in which Israel used phosphorus bombs, which are banned, which Israel has signed a treaty to ban these weapons. They're only allowed to be used as a smoke screen for your troops when they are advancing or retreating from the battlefield. But they use that in highly populated areas and suburbs of Gaza. and the Gaza Strip. Really, these are war crimes.
Tuma, can we go back one step? Zionism. You have mentioned this a number of times. Can you define what Zionism is?
Zionism is a movement started by the Jews, as I said, at the turn of the 19th and 20th century, to establish a home for Jews in Palestine. But the thing that one must remember is that the Zionists have never been religious Jews. Zionism is based on the mission and ideology that Jews should forget the religious past. They should join modern times and become a state and join Western countries in becoming a model state in the Middle East. And of course, they will provide a home for Jews who want to come and settle in Palestine. A fact that the Jews and the Israelis don't admit is that many Jews at the time, over 100 years ago, when the Zionist movement sprang up and became known around the world with its ideology and its calling for a homeland for the Jews in Palestine, many of the religious Jews were against that. And if you go to a website called Naturi Karta, nkuk.org, nkuk.org, these are religious Jews who are anti-Zionists. But not all Zionists are Jews. You have a lot of people in the West who are Zionists. Churchill was one. The vice president of Obama, Biden or Biden, he's a declared Zionist. And he said, if you Google him, you'll read and see him on video clips saying, I am a Zionist. You don't have to be a Jew to be a Zionist. I'm all for Israel. So there is a big difference between being a Jew and being a Zionist. Jews, the majority of them, are really honest, peaceful people. But Zionism had distorted this image of the Jew. And Zionism thrives on creating and fueling anti-Semitism. This is the criticism or being anti-Jewish. They love that because it serves their purposes.
And Zionists are very well funded?
Oh yes, they are the ones who have got the money. They own the banks all over the world. Not just in the Middle East, but in the Wall Street. The center of commerce in the world is, if you look at the names and the people who own and manage these banks, they are American Jews. In Britain, the same. The families like the Montefiores, the Rothschilds, the Levines, they are known to be quite wealthy people who fund settlement programs in Israel and in the occupied Palestinian territories.
And the media?
The media, they also control a lot of the media. But because they are very influential people, those media outlets that are not owned by Jewish concerns are frightened that if they appear to be having a balanced coverage of the situation between the Palestinians and the Israelis, which will entail quite a bit of criticism of Israeli policies, they've been threatened that many of the sponsors and advertisers will pull their advertisements out of those newspapers or television outlets and radio stations. So they have a lot of power and influence over that.
I'm speaking with Tuma Hazu, who is a Palestinian. He's a refugee in New Zealand, and he has previously been with the BBC as a radio announcer, reporter, and producer. And Tuma, we have, of course, also the Palestinian Authority, and we have Hamas, and also there's a subgroup, Fatah.
Yeah.
Can you describe what's happening within the Palestinian framework of wishing to govern themselves?
Okay. The Palestinians fall into two factions, basically. Well, three. The two main ones. First is Fatah, which is semi-secular movement. It is the Palestinian Authority is based on the grassroots or of Fatah. And then there is Hamas, which is right-wing fundamental Muslim group. And there is also the independent, the elite, the intelligentsia of the Palestinians. But they are not interested in governing. They want the best for their people. Now, the question is, Hamas, who are Hamas? What is the history of Hamas? The point is, there was no Hamas before Israel occupied the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. Hamas sprang up in the aftermath of the 1967 war, when Israel moved across its borders, which are known as the Green Line, and occupied the rest of historical Palestine, the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. Hamas was a grassroots social movement. They came in to fill in the gaps in education, in healthcare, in food supplies, in medicines, which were gaps that the Israeli occupying authorities did not provide for the people on the West Bank and Gaza. So Hamas was a social movement with funding that managed to get these items for schools, for medicines. Also, during all that time, this is in the late 60s, 70s, and 80s, Israel was continuously closing down schools and universities in the West Bank and Gaza. So Hamas managed to open individual homes for students to come and be taught inside homes because they couldn't get to their schools because they either were closed or there were curfews and so on and so forth. So Hamas became popular. But the interesting thing is that Israel decided, since this movement was becoming popular in the 70s and early 80s, why not nourish it and support it as an alternative leadership for Fatah under Arafat, who were in exile in Lebanon? They wanted an alternative leadership because Fatah was very popular and strong. All the young people were joining Fatah to fight and liberate Palestine under Arafat's leadership. So the Israelis wanted an alternative movement. So they encouraged and funded Hamas. This is documented. People who hear me now say, oh, this is propaganda. Go and Google Hamas and find Google Israeli support for Hamas. And you'll get it all from Israeli and American sources. Now, the same thing applies to Hezbollah. Hezbollah is a Shiite Muslim faction in South Lebanon. But if you look before 1982, i.e., before the invasion and occupation of Israel, of South Lebanon, you'll find there is no Hezbollah. Again, Hezbollah sprang up as a resistance movement against the presence of foreign Israeli troops occupying their land. So Israel is to blame for these two, let's call them terrorist groups. You see? But they don't want to admit that. And what's wrong with people standing up to defend their territory that is occupied by foreigners? Hamas against the occupying Israeli forces. Of course, Israel now has moved out of Israel. There are no settlements in the Gaza Strip. But they control it. They are in and out every night. If you look at the internet, you can see how many incursions and attacks by Israeli troops inside Gaza or along the coast against Gaza fishermen, sabotaging farmland in Gaza. The same again, if we look at the images of the flotilla and the commandos landing from Israeli helicopters on those ships carrying humanitarian aid, the Israelis up in arms, saying, you know, our troops, our soldiers were defending themselves. What about the right of those people on those ships to defend themselves against descending armed commandos, descending from helicopters to attack them? Isn't that the right? And on the high seas, in international waters.
Yes, I heard that the Turks made sure that all the goods and products on these ships were lawful. They made sure, prior to the embarking and leaving Turkey, that there was no arms, yes, no guns, ammunition, or anything like that.
Yes, because, you see, Israel has set out to almost starve the people of Gaza. It's mass punishment. Why? Because the Gaza people decided to elect Hamas. And they don't like Hamas. And the Americans don't like Hamas. Now, the West, led by America, were encouraging the Palestinians to elect a new leadership using democratic Western methods and institutions. The Palestinians did that in 2006. But the result didn't please the Israelis and the Americans, because they chose Hamas as a leadership to represent them. Because the other party, Fatah, is corrupt, was corrupt, and is still corrupt to this day. Fatah is financed by the Americans. They pay the salaries of Palestinian civil servants on the West Bank, and they give the Palestinian Authority millions of dollars to control the people on the West Bank. They are doing the job, the dirty work of the Israelis. Instead of Israel suppressing the people and stopping them from opposing the occupation, it is the Palestinian Authority and its security branches who are doing the dirty job for the Israelis.
So Yasser Arafat was corrupt.
No, not Yasser Arafat, but his Fatah movement was corrupt, because it was in his interest to keep certain cronies around in sensitive positions in government and in management of funds and resources. And this was carried on after his death by the current leadership, by Mahmoud Abbas and his own cronies.
There is a question that I hear. The rocket launchings from within the Palestinian areas towards Israel. Are these young, rebellious youth who are just so angry and outraged that they're prepared to do anything? Because when a rocket attack happens, then the Israelis come in with huge firepower and the so-called collateral damage is immense. Can you explain a little bit?
Well, you have to look at it from the Palestinian point of view. The Palestinian rockets are only retaliation towards what Israel does to the people in Gaza. The trouble with the media here in the West, they don't tell you what the Israelis do on a daily and day and night basis to the Gaza people. So the young Palestinians retaliate by lobbing these homemade rockets, which haven't really, I think in the last couple of years, 3 or 4 years, only 19 Israelis were killed by these rockets. 13 of them were in the Israeli incursion in late December 2008 and January 2009, when they killed 1,400 plus Palestinians. And of those 13 Israelis that were killed in the clash then between the Israelis and the Hamas and other Islamic Jihad groups, 5 were killed by Israeli friendly fire. I mean, the word disproportionate is even an understatement of what the Israelis do.
So the Israelis are basically needling and prodding the Palestinians all the time through, well, all these settlements that seem to be...
Yes, well, you see, now there are settlements on the West Bank with about, including East Jerusalem, 500,000 Israeli settlers living on Palestinian land in homes and apartment blocks that have been built with the support by the Israeli authorities, funded through the $3.5 billion that the Americans give to the Israelis every year. I, for one, hold the Americans responsible for the continuing violence in the Middle East. $3.5 billion, even at this dark time, economic times, when everybody is cutting down on expenses and government expenditure in the West, including America, America itself pays the Israelis $3.5 billion a year. And much of that money goes into building settlements on occupied territory. And then we go back to the young Palestinians. In a place like Gaza, which is overcrowded, where 80% of the workforce is out of work, young people who've gone to university and schools and have nothing to do, there is nowhere to go, there are no playgrounds, there are no decent streets, there are many parts of Gaza, there are sewage, open sewage in the middle of the street. On the West Bank, people living in refugee camps, like in Gaza, they look over the barbed wire. And what do they see? They see settlements, lovely villas with lawns and gardens in bloom, with children in swimming pools. Yet they, the Palestinians, who are seeing this on their own usurped land across the barbed wire, are lucky if they have a bath once a month. And people blame these people for becoming violent. And they say, oh, the Palestinians teach their children to hate us, to hate the Jews. What do you want me to say? Love those people who have killed your sister and brother and your six-month-old baby and 80-year-old grandfather and grandmother? Why do you expect that of these people? I think the tragedy of Israel and the Jews is the following. The Jewish people are the people who were the worst persecuted people in the history of mankind. The persecution of the Jews at the hands of Nazi Germany, which culminated in the Holocaust. 6.5 million people just perished in gas chambers and burned and massacred. Now, I think the tragedy is that the offsprings of these people and those who survived Auschwitz and Belsen and other concentration camps and moved into Israel, they and their offsprings are persecuting the Palestinians. There is no difference to me as a Palestinian from putting me in a gas chamber and dropping a phosphorus bomb above me. You know, the Almighty, if we want to go to the heavenly commands, said, thou shalt not kill. It didn't say you can kill somebody with a shotgun, but not a 500-millimeter machine gun. It said, thou shalt not kill. And the Jews have been ordered not to kill the innocent and the civilians. And one more thing, if you look at the history of the Arabs and the Jews have always found shelter and refuge in Arab lands. At the height of Arab civilization and glory in the Andalus, in southern Spain, the Jews joined forces with the Muslim Arabs in Spain against the Christian monarchs. And when the Christian monarchs regained control of the land in Spain and kicked out the Muslims, the Moors and Arabs, what did the Jews do? They went with the Arabs across the Straits of Gibraltar back into North Africa. They felt safer with the Arabs than being with the Christian rulers of Spain. Until now, you have communities, thriving communities, who refuse to go to Israel in Morocco and Algeria and Tunisia. So the history between the two countries, there is no bad maltreatment of Jews by Arabs and Muslims. Because the Muslims have instructions in their ethics and in Islam to protect those of the book. Those people of the book are the Jews and the Christians, the two peoples who believe in the same God like the Muslims. And they are ordered to protect these people. So that's the tragedy, that why should I as a Palestinian pay the price of what Germany did to the Jews in the Second World War, or the persecution of Jews throughout history by Christian societies, whether it was royalist Tsarist Russia in the East, or in Britain or Italy or France in the West. Why should I pay that price? I wasn't behind the Nazi treatment of Jews. I am the victim now, but now I have a new label. Because I stand up and claim my rights, I'm a terrorist. I'm denied the right to resist an occupying power.
Well, you found sanctuary in New Zealand at the moment, Tuma. And what's happening, though, is we are learning a lot more. With the internet in particular, we are finding out by being resourceful ourselves, we're researching and getting an understanding that there is a whole nother story about what is happening in Palestine. And what can we do now? How are we able to resolve this conflict so that we scale back all this violence and see each other as brothers and sisters?
Well, there is really an easy way out. There is a solution for the problem. The Palestinians are content to be left alone on what is left of historical Palestine, which is the 22%. That is the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. They are telling the Israelis and the world, let the occupation of these areas end so that we can set up a state of our own and call this our home and live alongside Israel with dignity and freedom and sovereignty. But the Israelis don't want that. They refuse to give the Palestinians back the territory that they occupied and still occupy till now. They want their cake and eat it. And unless they do that, that the future is black for both peoples. There won't be ever peace in that part of the world. Some justice has to be done. The Palestinians have been the victims, and the violence and oppression of them must stop. Enough is enough. You know, you cannot deny the Gaza people access to cement to build their broken homes. The bombardment that left thousands and thousands of homes in ruins. People in Gaza have moved from being refugees about three times in their lifetime. They can't get basic material. Even the United Nations has said only 20% of the basic essentials of life in Gaza is allowed in. So, what is the end? I mean, I don't know. The Israelis must look into their hearts and ask, this insecurity that we always feel, is it of our own doing or not? If they can ask that, themselves that, I think that would be the right step forward towards a brighter future for them and people around them. And I'm not talking about just the Palestinians, but the whole region and maybe the future of mankind on this planet. Because we don't want the story of Samson and the temple to be repeated. Israelis have got nuclear weapons, and we don't want to reach a stage where they feel that for our security we've got to use these weapons, because that would be opening the gates of hell for everybody on this planet. I hope I'm wrong. but I might sound very pessimistic, but I'm an informed optimist.
Tuma, in closing, Jimmy Carter, the ex-president of America, to my understanding, has really had a closer look and is very much in favor of the Palestinians having far more say in their life. He wants a Palestinian state. Is that not true?
That's true. I think Jimmy Carter was the American president who did most for Israel. He managed to secure a peace treaty between Israel and the strongest Arab army, the Egyptians, during his term of office at the White House. The second thing is that Jimmy Carter isn't for the Palestinians per se. He's saying that if Israel continues with its present policies, ongoing policies against the Palestinians, it will end up as an apartheid state. And he wrote a book a couple of years ago where he said, Palestine, peace or apartheid. And he wasn't referring to Israel in its own internationally recognized boundaries. He was talking about Israeli presence on the West Bank and Gaza. Because what is happening now is akin to South Africa under white apartheid rule. The Israelis want to control, they want to move people and allocate them certain areas, other areas for their own settlers. There shouldn't be mixing between the two. All the resources should be in favor of the settlers, and so on and so forth. And the Palestinians should have no freedom of movement, no freedom, no future. So he's saying for the sake of the future of both peoples, the Israelis and the Palestinians, the current situation cannot be sustained. It must be turned around. And the only way to do it, that's what Jimmy Carter is saying, is for the Israelis to put an end to their occupation of Palestinian territories in the West Bank and Gaza.
Tuma, can we look back at the historical roots of what happened between the Jews and the Arabs 1,500 years ago?
A fact that very few people know about, and those who are pro-Israelis and many Jews don't want to be reminded of, is the fact that when the Crusaders were in the Middle East during the Crusades over a period of 200 years, each successive crusade which became successful and pushed out the Muslim armies out of Jerusalem and other parts of Palestine, the first thing they did, they banished the Jews out of Jerusalem. No Jew was allowed to live in Jerusalem during the Crusader regimes in the Holy Land. Now, another interesting thing, when the king Umar ibn al-Khattab, he used to be called Caliph. Caliph Umar ibn al-Khattab, when he succeeded in pushing the Crusaders out of Jerusalem, he was met by religious leaders from the Muslim communities in Jerusalem, from the different Christian denominations in Jerusalem. But he turned around and he said, but where are the Jewish religious leaders? Where are the rabbis? Why aren't they here? Because he was surprised that they were not there to welcome him. And one of the Christian leaders, religious leaders, turned around to him and said, Your Majesty, didn't you know that the Crusaders don't allow Jews to live in Jerusalem? They've been exiled out of Jerusalem. He said, that's nonsense. This Jerusalem is a city holy to both Muslims, Christians, and Jews. And he turned around to his aides and he said, send word around to the Jews in Palestine that they must come back and live in Jerusalem because this is their city. This is another example of the relationship between the magnanimity of Arabs and the relationship of Arabs to Jews. Jews have always been protected by the Arabs.
Tuma, there is a group here in New Zealand called Kiwis for a Balanced Coverage of the Conflict in the Middle East. Can you elucidate?
Yes, well, there is a group. I don't know who's behind it, but they always, you will see their advertisements whenever they see something that upsets them. If there is any sort of criticism of Israeli action against the Palestinians, they will send letters to the media. If these letters are not, and articles of these are not accepted by the media, they will publish them as advertisements. And it is really, many of these advertisements are horrendous lies and myths and misinformation, and many of them are really obscene. For instance, I'll give you an example. In around Christmas or January, when we had that horrendous earthquake in Haiti, Israel sent a group, a team of Israeli personnel, medical staff, people with sniffer dogs who could locate bodies on rubble and so on. And these people, Kiwis for Balanced Coverage in the Middle East, published an advert which the papers refused to publish as part of their editorial or content of the newspaper, so it was published as an advertisement. They were complaining that why doesn't the Kiwi newspapers and media outlets talk about the fantastic, honorable job that the Israeli teams did in Haiti. And they published a picture of the Israeli rescue teams pulling out some people from under the rubble in Port-au-Prince in Haiti. And they ridiculed Arab media, including Saudi Arabia newspapers, where they only sent the Haitian people condolences. I wanted to ask these people, why don't you publish similar pictures of your fantastic, courageous, noble Israeli armed forces pulling victims from under the rubbles of Gaza as a result of the incursion in Gaza in January 2009, when, you know, as a result, 1,462 Palestinians were left dead, many of them children. Why don't you publish? Did your government send such rescue teams into Gaza? Of course not. But here you are boasting that you sent, as part of a public relations, to balance the anti-Israeli coverage of the Israeli military actions in Gaza. They sent a military group, a medical group, a rescue team into Haiti. So these people are funded by Israel, because I don't believe a small group of Kiwis can afford to put half a page, quarter page advertisements in newspapers, at the same time in the Herald, in the Dominion Post, in the I've seen one in the Otago Times, and not once, not twice, but over a long period. This must total some $500,000. So I think this money is coming from Israel. I know that Israel set aside $33 million to combat the bad reputation and coverage that it had as a result of its attack on Gaza in 2009. So these people claim, you know, they are for balanced coverage. You can't balance good with evil. Just because you do something terrible, the newspaper must say something good about you. So this is Kiwis for Balanced Coverage of the Middle East. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much, Tuma, for coming and explaining to us in more detail this complex challenge that we as a humanity have to face.
Well, I have the pleasure and honor to have been given this opportunity to let the Palestinian narrative be heard for a change. And I hope there is now a change in public opinion. More and more people are understanding the situation, asking questions, about what is happening, and I hope this will continue so that somehow, collectively, we can come to a positive conclusion to this really horrendous and bloody conflict that has gone for decades. It must come to an end. Thank you.
That was Tuma Hazu, Middle East analyst and Palestinian.